There will be a whole group that line up and say, work harder. Get over it. Try harder. Turn it over. What aren't you doing right? Now, these are all people who've never been depressed. Okay? At the International Conference in Seattle, one of the speakers was a woman named Eve Marsh. She's since died. She got sober the year I was born. And Eve was talking about depression. I mean, you can just, everyone stop breathing, you know, when she said the word. Because it's such a fear. I mean, it is scarier to talk about depression for alcoholics than to talk about sex. And if you talk about sex at an AA meeting, even the non-smokers light up. I mean, they all get very anxious. Very anxious. Yeah. So Eve said she used to, when people came in and said, I'm so depressed, she used to give them, you know, little pep talks or ridicule them or humiliate them or tell them to get off the pity pot. You're just full of self-pity. That's your problem. Oh, thank you. That really helps. And she said the reason she did that was she had never been depressed. And then she said, and then I had my double mastectomy. And I got depressed. And I found out that depression was as real as a broken leg. You know? Get over that broken leg, you know? Let's get walking! Well, depression lasts. Sometimes for days, sometimes for weeks, sometimes for months, sometimes longer. And it takes a lot of effort to walk through it. Bill writes about this with great clarity. He says, this is Bill now. When I was tired and couldn't concentrate, he would write to other depressed people who were sober. And these are all in the archives in New York. Bill has a whole... When I was tired and couldn't concentrate, you know, you're exhausted and you can't read. You can't even watch... sound bites, you know, are for people who are depressed. That's all you can remember is 12 seconds, you know. And then you do the next one. I used to fall back on an affirmation toward life that took the form of simple walking and deep breathing. Simple walking. This, by the way, is one of the forms that people who practice Zen do to meditate. Walking and breathing. You don't need a lot of accoutrement or fanciness. It's just move, breathe. It's basic. I sometimes told myself that I couldn't even do this, that I was too weak. But I learned that this was the point at which I could not give in without becoming still more depressed. And if you ever dealt with depression yourself, you know that you can't get out of bed. And if you don't get out of bed, it gets worse. What are you going to do? I'm going to shower.
Oh, God.
It's wonderful to get that far, you know, and then we'll deal with socks, you know, later in the day. So I would set myself a small stint. I would determine to walk a quarter of a mile, and I would concentrate by counting my breathing, say, 6 steps to each slow inhalation and 4 to each exhalation. Having done the quarter mile, I found that I could go on maybe a half mile more, then another half mile, and maybe another. This was encouraging. The false sense of physical weakness would leave me. That's one of the other things that always happens when you're depressed. You feel physically worn out, weak, exhausted, frail. Objectively, it might not be true at all, but that's how you're feeling. So, of course, you can't move. You can't swim. You can't walk. You can't get on the bicycle. You don't have the strength. It is as big a trap to be in as the drinking. This false sense of physical weakness would leave me, this feeling being so characteristic of depressions. The walking and especially the breathing were powerful affirmations towards life and living and away from failure and death. The counting represented a minimum discipline of concentration to get some rest from the wear and tear of fear and guilt. That's what Bill writes. And then the commentary goes on, Bill would also push himself to write just half a page for the 12 steps and 12 traditions. This is that second little book that AA uses. He writes that book in his depression, which gives it much more value to me, knowing that. He didn't just dash it off. The New York AA Archives file of letters Bill wrote to others suffering from depression, as he did, shows the many ways Bill struggled to climb out of depression. Nell Wing, Bill's secretary, claimed those close to Bill were deeply concerned. She mentioned days when Bill would be dictating to her only to stop and break down weeping. From 1944 to 1955. Who's that old guy crying in the back office? Oh, he's the founder of AA. How long has he been sober? 10 years? 12 years? 15 years? To say it out loud is real important. To give all of us permission when we talk to tell the truth. How are you doing? Sometimes pretty well, sometimes not so well. And if you're not doing so well, it's real important to be able to say that at a meeting. Or at least to some people who are safe. Because otherwise what happens is some of us are smiling brave little smiles and thinking of shooting ourselves because we don't know another way out. And then we'll take responsibility for the group. Well, I can't tell the group I'm down. What will they do? They'll practice their program, is what they'll do. See, we start taking care of each other, so I have to lie to take care of you. This makes us very sick. I was told that the reason the program works is that we're not all crazy on the same day. But we all get to be crazy, and especially when there's stuff going on with spouses or siblings or children or grandchildren. We get affected. And if I'm having emotional upset or depression or sorrow or anger, I need to be able to talk about that in a safe place. What makes a place safe? Let me tell you why my sponsor is safe to talk to for me, even though he needs meetings much more than I do. He listens. He doesn't need to comment on everything I say. Okay, he listens. Sometimes he comments on things I'd rather he overlooked. You know, something I just slipped in at the end he wants to go back to and say, what did that mean? Oh, it's nothing. I was just buying guns. After he listens, he will sometimes share his experience, strength, and hope on a similar matter. He doesn't tell me what to do. Only once has he done that, and that was because it was really crazy. He told me what not to do, you know, which was my plan. He said, don't do that today. You know, we can talk about that tomorrow. So I followed his directions. But he shares his experience. He doesn't lecture me because it doesn't work. He doesn't try to scare me because that doesn't work either. I mean, I can't be scared. I mean, I'm an ex-smoker. You know, you can't scare us. I remember when I was still able to smoke and climb upstairs, which I was not able to do at my last couple years of smoking. My folks, very concerned about my health and my smoking, my chronic smoking, they would send me Reader's Digest articles about I'm Joe's lung. You know, very helpful. Or stuff from the American Cancer Society, you know. And these are, by the way, big Al-Anon slips. Because, I mean, I'm very concerned for you and that you send anonymous things in the mail. you're trying to run the other person's life. Well, when I would get that stuff, it would just piss me off. And instead of saying, see, if I were a more well-put-together person, I would say, oh, look, literature about my health. Thank you very much. I'll follow your good advice. You're not dealing with someone like that. You're dealing with someone who is stubborn and cranky and contrary. So So when I would get literature like that, it added 5 years to my smoking. In fact, I could still be smoking and it'd be their fault. You know? See how the thinking is? This is why it is not helpful with many of us to give advice. Because if you're like me, you don't follow advice. Even if you're bleeding and on fire, you'd rather not follow advice. The advice is put out the fire and stop the bleeding. Ha! What do you know? The fire doesn't bother me that much. I mean, look who you're dealing with. So he doesn't do that with me. He doesn't try to scare me. Also, he knows that inspiring little talks don't work. Let me give you an inspiring little talk, Tom. I'm too cynical. It makes me crazy. When I hear, and this happens in church too, when I hear these inspiring little talks, I just want to drink. And I know I shouldn't. I should be very careful in watching political conventions for this reason. Because, I mean, the pictures painted are so unrealistic. They're just so pink and fluffy and happy if you only let us run your life. And I find myself reacting, not acting, but reacting. However, again, how does my sponsor deal with me in terms of Al-Anon issues? He listens, he shares his experience. Every so often he underlines something I've said. And he'll say something like, that's real important to pay attention to. He's not a control freak. He's too self-obsessed to worry about others. That's nice. And it's one of the real benefits of self-obsession, you know. Some of us aren't self-obsessed. We only worry about others, and therefore we think we're having a close personal relationship with this person. But we're not. We're just worrying, you know. Learning how to talk about our experience, strength, and hope without trying to run the world, without taking hostages, and without full of criticism is the Al-Anon blessing. It's the Al-Anon blessing. And you can see people practice this. I'm very lucky in my sponsor. He uses both programs. His father was also alcoholic, and his father died when Terry was a little boy. His father died on a slip. You know, people die on slips. And he knew a lot about alcoholism and the family disease, and read the big book before he took his first drink. You know, and then of course after the first drink, off to the races. You know, there's life to live. Oh well. He believes strongly that he has no right to protect me from my own pain. Well, this is hard, because if you love someone, you don't want them to hurt. But the fact is, sometimes the only way you grow up is by hurting. And sometimes the most loving thing we can do for another person is to give them the respect of their own pain. I did some Elizabeth Kubler-Ross stuff, and I find her to be very, very inspiring. She can give me inspiring little talks that I don't jump out of a chair or pass out. But she talks, I mean, from this wealth of experience. And when we were on this 5-day workshop, when we're dealing with death and dying, and people are there with cancer and all kinds of diseases and healthcare professionals, and it was very, very powerful. She said, you know what happens a lot of times in groups like this? We're going to talk about some very, very powerful stuff. People will be sharing, and someone will start crying. And the first response a lot of us will have is go over and hug them. She says, you know what the hug says? Stop crying. You're making us all nervous. Well, I just want to give them comfort. No, no. You want to give you comfort. You see, their crying is making you crazy. I'm cold, you wear a coat. You see? And she said, so we're going to allow, at this five-day thing, we're going to allow people to be uncomfortable. And if someone's crying, let them cry. And don't grab their little hand. Let them cry. Show them the respect of their feeling. And by, so that's one side of it. Another side of it is some people cry to control the room. See, if I am clearly the bird with the broken wing, you're going to give me my way. Some alcoholics figured this out years ago. And so the craziest person in the group is the most powerful person in the group. In Al-Anon, we learn how to act, not react. And if someone's in crisis, they get to be in crisis. If someone cries, they get to cry. There's a wonderful movie that I would recommend. It's about very crazy families. It's an older film now. It's the first film I was able to cry in. It's called Ordinary People, with Mary Tyler Moore and Donald Sutherland and Timothy Hutton. And it's about a family that experienced a tragedy and the whole family went crazy. It's, I guess, made in the early 80s. And it's not a light film. I mean, this is about real human interaction. But the young man that Timothy Hutton plays has a lot of stuff, and he has a suicide attempt, and he is sent to the shrink by the family, so he will get better, but we're not going to talk about it. You know, the big elephant in the living room, the big rhinoceros in the living room. We just want the kid to get better, but we don't want to talk about it. Look good, smile, how are you? Fine, thanks. I went to see it in an afternoon. I was living and working in Los Angeles at the time, and halfway through the film I just started sobbing, and it was the first time I'd cried in sobriety, and I think I was sober 4 years. And so I went back the next day and cried when the credits came on the screen. I mean, I just started sobbing, you know. I had so many uncried tears, and for some of us who do that, you know, Kubler-Ross thinks that if you have a lot of lung problems, it's uncried tears. If asthma, problems breathing, congestion, it's uncried tears. It's unworked grief. And so she's, as a physician and a psychiatrist, she says, if you can get people with severe asthma to cry, this will help them. So some of us, though, we're just so congested and we're convinced if we start to cry, we'll never stop. Well, the fact is you will. I mean, it might not be for a while, but you will. But loss of control, what will people say? I can't break down in the family. Go to the movies. coming back in crises. The detachment. And you can say, the wing is broken. We're still doing. Letting someone else be in pain, letting someone else hurt, takes every fiber of my Al-Anon recovery. Because I don't want anyone to ever hurt. So, talking with my sponsor, I went through, I would say, a pretty significant depression about 8 years ago, 9 years ago. I had been in, well, I was doing a lot of things, you know, life was happening, and I knew I needed some time off, and so I took some time off. This was January, February, March. I'd have to look up the year it was, but it was about 5 or 8 years ago. And I just kind of fell apart. And everything was bleak, and I was trying some things, all of which were just exploding in my face, and nothing was working, and I was getting worse and worse, by which I mean I was feeling worse and worse. So after a month, not even a month, say 3 weeks of that, I called my sponsor, and I said, this is what's going on, I'm really a mess. And he said, then he said, you've worked real hard to get here. This is important stuff. Don't rush to put a Band-Aid over this. It's real important you pay attention to this. What are you doing to help yourself? And I was talking to a couple of older priests. I really needed it because I was having, it was with everything else, of course, church stuff, you know, one more wrinkle in my Al-Anon program. Church stuff, family stuff, friendship stuff, it was all up. Personal health stuff, it was all up. What tools are you using? What are you doing to, you know, get some of the help you need? And he said, take all the time you need to get well. Take all the time you need to get well. And he showed great compassion. But he didn't tell me what I should be feeling, should be thinking, should be doing. You know? And it took a while. It took probably 3 or 4 months of what I would call a lot of doing not much else. And I started feeling like a human being again. Also, how does he use an Al-Anon program with me? He doesn't run up to me with a lot of advice. I've mentioned that. He doesn't send me self-help books, for which I am so grateful, I can't tell you. My dad died this summer, and he's been frail the last couple of years, and this is a big deal. This is a big deal. And so I mentioned this at a meeting, and someone came up and said, I have some great books on grief. And I said, I've read all those books on grief. My problem is not information. Now I get to walk through it. And all the information in the world doesn't help at all. You just know that you're feeling really awful today, and it's there in the book. Oh, good. But what he does, he listens and he respects my insides. He respects my insides. And lets me feel my pain, that's number one. Number two, he lets me feel my hard-won pain. Number two, he's convinced that I have the right to live with the consequences of my mistakes. Again, this is very hard because if someone does stupid things, I want to intervene. Now, this is very crazy for those of us in Al-Anon because we do that a lot. We don't want people we love to have consequences for their awful behavior. Now, the great dividing line between adolescents and grown-ups, no matter how old you are, is grown-ups know that actions have consequences. Adolescents don't. And some people who are 46 years old, age-wise, and 15 years old emotionally, have never put together the fact that their actions have consequences. And if I don't let them put that together, I'm keeping them sick. I have to let some people go through awful things with great compassion. It's kind of a shock to me to realize that frequently love is not powerful in the way I want love to be powerful. If I love someone, I want to be able to fix them, protect them, help them, move them on to the next plane, you know? And I find that sometimes those I love the most, I am most powerless with. But I get to feel the vulnerability of it. And then I need a meeting real badly. So I can let them, show them the dignity of walking through their stuff. It's called detaching. It's called letting go. It's called taking care of my own business. Otherwise, if I'm busy intervening all over your life, I'm playing God. I'm fixing you. I'm doing everything imaginable to make sure that you don't have your own life. And I've got to, as we say in California, I have to respect your own process. Now, does that mean I cannot be helpful? No. I want to be very helpful, but I want to be appropriately helpful. And this is a big topic. See, there are some things I should not do for you. Ever. You've got to do them yourself. There are other things I better not do for you. I mean, you actually will be better off if I don't. There are other things I may do for you. I can be genuinely helpful, but I get to choose where that is, and I want that, because I'm so limited, I want that to go where it's helpful most, not where it gets in your way. And that means I have to talk about it and pray over it and interact with it. Sometimes people who are new to codependency world get a little black and white. I was walking somewhere and they opened the door for me and said, "Oh, I'm sorry for being codependent." Good manners are not codependency. Courtesy is not codependency. Politeness is not codependency. Those are the things that help us get along with difficult people, namely ourselves. And I
and just
serenity prayer and then tie all loose ends together and make perfect sense out of our lives and judge others effectively. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. There sure are lots of ways of being crazy, and we're in a world where there's vast amounts of it in lots of ways. One of the ways I understand most obsessive compulsive behavior is that people are, and this is putting on the psychological hat, but people are obsessive and compulsive because they don't want to feel. And rather than feeling, you act out obsessively compulsively. You will find people do this drinking, they will do this drugging, they will do this sexually, they will do this religiously, they will do this politically. Rather than feel, you get obsessive and compulsive about ways of thinking, ways of behaving. Rather than feel, I'm going to clean everything. Rather than feel, I'm going to rearrange everything. Rather than feel, I'm going to cut the lawn again. Rather than feel, I'm going to have sex with 97 people soon as I find them. Rather than feel, and this is a lot of, rather than feel, I'm going to overeat. Rather than feel, I'm going to smoke. I mean, that makes great sense to me. And so when I deal with folks who are pretty compulsive and obsessive, I just need to know that. You know? And I can identify with all sorts of areas in there because I get into that kind of behavior too. my family, political stuff was always a real thing in my family, and looking back on me as an adolescent and as a young man, a lot of my political activism was so I didn't have to feel some things. I mean, convictions came later. But a lot of my acting out was so I didn't have to feel some of the awkwardness and some of the insecurity. I know I bumped into somebody a while ago on a retreat, and her family is religiously crazy. They get all off on God, Catholic Church stuff, and everybody, I mean, it seems to me, the family's full of rage and abuse and power, and dad's in charge and you cannot be loyal enough to the Pope. And I mean, the family's crazy. And to say, oh, they're a very holy family, they're not holy, they're nuts. And when they talk to any church people, they're full of suspicion. Can they trust you enough? It's paranoia. It's again, rage. But rather than be honest in their stuff, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of grief and hurt in there down deep, but it takes the form of toxic faith, religious craziness. Lots of it. So they're sure, you know that compulsive, obsessive people are starting to get well when they begin to have an emotional life. The problem with emotions is they're not neat. They're not, and they're not efficient. And we're a culture that values efficiency and neatness. Now, I have no problem with efficiency and neatness, but there are some times when I'm not neat and I'm not efficient. And I have to give some permission. I have to do some self-acceptance on that. I mean, if all I was going to do was sit and feel, nothing would get done. So people who mostly feel drive me crazy, too. You know, I have one sponsee, I think, who will call and say, Tom, since we talked last, I've had 87 feelings. I'd like to talk with you about each one of them. And he's not that interesting. I mean, he is totally fascinated. Then I felt a little insecure. Then I felt so happy. I just glaze over and I do crossword puzzles. Always carry a New York Times crossword puzzle with you. So you have something to do when you're listening to one of your sponsees who is so boring you can't stand it. That's one of the little secrets of sponsorship. Always do crossword puzzles. So, I mean, we get into a thing of balance here in recovery, you know? Some kind of balance and a little less self-obsession. Somebody during the breaks... And again, realize the culture's nuts. We value efficiency and the bottom line, and everything else gets sacrificed to that. All of these human and family values get ground up in the marketplace. We think that's just, you know, the grand. What happens if you're not always able to operate at peak performance? Well, we're pretty harsh on you. But the fact of the matter is, the reason it's called peak performance is because it doesn't happen very often. Keep in mind Isaac Newton. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. I have times when I function very, very highly. Most weekends, I have to be on a lot. Highly organized, clear, give points, listen to people, be attentive. I'm not real up on Mondays. And I used to think that I had an incurable illness. It must be brain cancer, you know, or, you know, every Monday I had diphtheria or AIDS. I mean, something is seriously wrong. Or I'm sure I have chronic fatigue because every Monday I have no interest in even reading the paper. And this went on for years until someone finally pointed out that from Friday until Sunday I am up. And that means Monday and Tuesday, I get to be down. I need the breaks. This is part of the understanding of Sabbath. I need the break. So am I always at a 10? No. Is it okay to be at an 8? 8's real good. Is it okay to operate at 5? Sometimes 5 is real good. What about a 2? You're still functioning. Good for you. You know? There are times like that, and I want to give myself all that permission. Some days are easier than others. That's right. This is called life. I was full of woe and complaint. One of the women who runs the Chrysalis Center for Women in Oakland, which is a women's recovery house, is a kind of an earth mother named Mary. And Mary is unflappable. This is why sometimes I just call Mary. And I was talking with her about how awful my life was, and everything was going wrong, and I wasn't getting my own way, and I was tired and cranky and angry and hostile. And it was all their fault. And she said, and I thought this was a big deal. I mean, these are emergencies I'm dealing with. And she said, Tom, it sounds to me like you've got a case of life. You know, it's just hard. So relax already. Relax already. You're feeling a little low. How about medication? Well, that's a judgment call. Some people need medication. If the stuff is biological, some people need it. Others of us don't. I take thyroid because mine's dead. But otherwise, you know. Part of recovery, this a good ethics is based on a good biology. Part of recovery is to see a physician regularly and get a checkup, especially if you're feeling lousy. There might be something physically wrong. You know, I mean, there might... A lot of us who are in Al-Anon live with just a little bit of stress. And sometimes that has real physical repercussions. And I know a number of untreated Al-Anons who have simply turned over and died from the stress. We get worn out. We get exhausted. When I mentioned this thing I went through, 5 or 8 years ago, talking to my sponsor, you know, and who said, don't put a Band-Aid on it. One of the pieces of footwork I did is I got a physical. And you got a little feedback. And he said, oh, you're fine physically. You know, anything going on otherwise? Oh, you know. Taking the Reagan presidency a little seriously. A little personally, you know. And he said, well, there's medication. And I said, well, let's talk about that. And we had a conversation. And I decided no. But we talked about it. And if I was profoundly depressed and wasn't washing or leaving my room for 6 months in a row, I'd want to be on it to get me to a place where I rediscovered hygiene. Anyway, seems to me. Now this is. I mean, I give myself permission. Sometimes I function real well. Sometimes I don't function real well. The holidays are real stressful for lots of us, especially in Al-Anon with family craziness up. You have the constitutional right to enjoy the holidays if you want to, and if you don't want to observe the holidays, don't. What are they going to do? Yell at you again? If you entertain ungrateful people year after year after year, who's the crazy one? I want you to know that on Christmas Day and New Year's Day, movie houses are full of people from crazy families. What'd you do on Christmas this year? We went to 6 movies. Good for you. Give yourself options. One of my cousins who is way from the way she handles Christmas is she travels to non-Christian countries. Where she doesn't have to put up with that crap from anyone, is the way she explains it. Little hostility there. But she looks forward to the holidays now, you know, because she goes to places where she... But we get to make choices as grown-ups. And in the last hour or two, I talked about how, you know, there are problems other than alcohol with women and men we love, and that's important to know. That's also true for us. Also, healing for the addict and alcoholic is a slow process. And just know that. Know that. And frequently it's a spiral process, and frequently it's 2 steps forward and sometimes 12 steps back. And then, you know, a little burgle of health. If they're suddenly perking up and looking like grown-ups, don't take it personally. If they're suddenly acting out like 9-year-olds, don't take it personally. Let them be. I know for me, after I started waking up off the chemicals, it was as if I had no skin on. I had no defenses. Because, see, booze was my defense. And then I started waking up, and where some of us, you know, are depressed and alcoholic, some of us are filled up with rage and alcoholic. And that's very difficult to live with. I know I went back to the classroom, and probably my hardest year in my sobriety, and it did lead me to Al-Anon, was my first year back in the classroom. I had no skills for dealing with the stresses other than booze and dope. So how on earth do you deal with stresses? And I fell back on 2 of my old tried and trues, and it was all verbal, to deal with people who got in my way. See, I used to be nice and polite frequently and then go drink it away. Now I couldn't drink it away, so verbally I became abusive and full of ridicule and put down. And that's how I dealt with a lot of my students. And I was sober 2, 3, 4 years, and in Al-Anon probably 2 years. So I'm in the program, working program, going to meetings every night. And it was time for student-teacher evaluations. And one of my students, I think his name was Mike, I remember the classroom vividly, and we were kind of doing some, how was the class, you know. And these were seniors, so these were people who were almost on the verge of humanity. You know, grown-up moments in public. This one young man turned to me and he said, "Father, you have a way of making people feel real small." Well, that was the ridicule, the sarcasm, that was the tool I was using to deal with stressful people. And I have had to learn other ways of dealing with stress. And the point is, it just takes a long time. And my great teacher is pain. I remember that scene with that young man vividly. Now, I can't remember his face, and I don't remember his name. But I remember what he said, because what he said was the truth. And I had to just kind of realize, I need to learn in recovery a whole new way of dealing with things. I really have to learn how to handle the tremendous stress, because the stress isn't going to go away. Not on this planet, not in this century. So what can I do? Well, I had better find some tools to use. And a big one is self-acceptance. When I give myself permission to be me as I am, it's a relief. Instead of, let's try harder to be different, to please these people you'll never see again. Or please certain relatives. They've never been pleased with you. It has nothing to do with you. They're crazy. So what should I do? Well, if you quote me on this, I will deny it. I don't return some phone calls. Now, some fall through the cracks. I mean, I would have returned the phone call, except I wrote the number down wrong. I mean, that happens. You need to know this. I am a little dyslexic when it comes to writing numbers, and regularly I reverse numbers. When I write them down, I mean, what a flaw! Yeah, I've had it for years. It's not going to go away. So some people call, I write the number down wrong, and I don't get back to them. I have one relative I don't call back, and I have the number, and it's right. And that's because there's nothing there but misery, and there's nothing I can do about it. What do I do with this relative? I send an occasional friendly postcard. That way I don't have to hear the voice back that will find fault with the postcard, you know. But I make a little bit of contact. But I avoid the messy situation. And I do this as a grown-up. I used to listen to this person for hours. Life is too short. And I simply don't have time. And what's also true is no one does. God does. We turn a lot of things over to the care of God because God has the time and the skill and the ability and the wisdom to work this out. That's a big turning it over. As Alan says in one of the meetings I go to, the reason step three follows step two is because sane people turn it over instead of trying to solve it ourselves over and over and over and over again. And some things just don't get solved. Not in this life, seems like. I mean, it's easy to see far away. You look at, like, the Northern Ireland mess, you know, which is a mess, has been for centuries. Peace accord signed. Okay, we're going to stop shooting each other's children. And then one group says, yeah, but we want to march through your part of town and rub your face in the dirt, reminding you that we beat the shit out of you 300 years ago. We want to do that one more time. It's our right. And the other group says, if you do that, we'll shoot you. But it's our right. Now let's talk about the peace accords. What does it take to get people to realize that behavior makes people crazy and some behavior can change? You know? Stop the marches. Just stop the marches. Stop reveling in the past and get to the present. Well, then we'd lose who we were. What's the loss? You know, when identity is all wrapped up in resentment and rage and power, it's a time to change, seems to me. Letting go of all those awful resentments. Now, I can't do anything about them. I can't do anything about a lot of things. The world's a mess. But there are some things I can change. And again, this is the Al-Anon focus. What can I change? And so I want to end up this morning by talking about little victories. Little victories. There are some things I can do. And frequently they look totally insignificant. However, they're victories. In my own, and again, it's my stuff, so adapt as you need. One of my abilities for years has been commenting on, particularly my mom, when my mom would say something that was really politically ridiculous. I would try to point that out. See? I thought this added to the family dialogue. And I'm sure that if I just pointed out her political craziness enough, she'd change her mind and agree with me, and then everyone would be happy. I did this for years. And what I would do is stir the pot, see, and make everybody nuts. I'd make my mom angry, and I'd embarrass my dad. I mean, I felt better about it. I was just expressing myself. I was being a jerk. So one night after I'd been going to Al-Anon for about 7 years, my mom said something ridiculous. And I noticed it was ridiculous. And I noticed, and this was a graced moment, I had the choice of pointing it out or not. instead of the knee-jerk reaction which had been there for years. And instead of pointing it out, I kept my big mouth shut. Since that time, we have gotten along better. It's a little tiny victory. A little tiny victory. When my dad was declared terminal, and I got to spend nights with him. I don't have a family to take care of. I mean, I could be there. And in a variety of ways, I opted out of the family craziness in various ways. I mean, I ran as far as I could,
you know.
So this was a chance to do some participation. And I was able to do it thanks to the program. But there's craziness going on, too. Anyway, he's declared terminal. He's 91. He's been frail for a couple of years. We all decide no unnecessary measures. We had not even talked about that before. But it was just the very clear thought, you know. So lunch comes, and I'm there, and I'm real jumped. I mean, I've had stuff with my dad, too. You know, I mean, who hasn't had stuff with parents? And my parents are in there, and, you know, I'm almost 50, and I don't know what to do, and I'm feeling like I'm 9. Lunch came, and he wanted to eat the ice cream first. And my mom told him, "You can't eat the ice cream first. You have to have the soup first." Okay? No control issues at my house. And what I wanted to do was have my bones jump out of my skin and scream at the top of my lungs, "He's terminal, give him the ice cream." I am grateful to every Al-Anon meeting I have ever been to, because instead of that option, I said, "I'm so uncomfortable, I'm going to burst into sweat." I got up, went out in the hall, and walked back and forth for about 15 minutes, reminding myself that they had worked this deal out long before I showed up. You know, this is their dance, not mine. And then I could come back, and it was when I was able to let go of that, and again, it was a huge letting go, a little victory. I didn't know what to do with my dad. I mean, like I say, we've never been chatty with each other. I suddenly realized, instead of treating him like my dad, why don't I treat him like an old sick guy who's dying? I have dealt with old sick guys who are dying for years. Soon as I realized that, I could be with him. I was able to touch him. I was able to talk to him. I was able to be present. This was a good thing for all of us. And I found the little victories, and it's an Al-Anon thing, letting go of some of my favorite issues, a lot of self-acceptance, not stirring the pot, being present, lots of people's insides got taken care of because we showed lots of respect to lots of people. And I got to spend the nights, and that meant did a little bit of conversation, not a lot, because we didn't have a lot to say to each other. But I was able to be physically present. I was able to rub feet. I was able to rub hands. I was able to put Vaseline on dry lips. I was able to give liquid. I was able to be there in a way that I never had been able to be present before. And I felt emotionally present, and I felt connected. And then I got to preside at the funeral, which was a great honor. And this was a good man who just wasn't very involved with the family, you know? Sure, not with me. But I asked someone else to preach because I didn't think I'd be able to do that for a lot of reasons. But I was able to preside and show him some respect and some dignity, and show respect and dignity for all of us. And it was a good thing. I mean, the Irish who have little, they say, the Irish love funerals. It's one of the things we've done well for years. And it was just, I mean, it was a grand funeral. It was a great letting go. It was a way of showing respect. No one was in active disease that day. It was a graced experience. And I found, dealing with my mom, when I'm dealing with her as my mom, I become nine. When I remember that this is a lady who's just lost her husband, I'm very present. That's what I have to remember in my head. Because otherwise I revert to type and start getting critical and awful, and, you know? So little victories. Little victories at home. I live in a neighborhood that has a lot of craziness. And one of the things I do for my own sake and to perk up the neighborhood is I have a front yard. I plant things. I grow things. And it's really nice sometimes. And there's these really awful apartment buildings. Some apartment buildings are wonderful. These are awful. To see people who are clearly in trouble, burdened, walking by and suddenly noticing the yard and going, oh, that's a great victory. That's a great victory. And I do it as, there's nothing I can do about Northern Ireland. But I can plant bulbs. I can cut back the roses. I can do these kinds of things in the yard. I can also pick up the trash. People litter. Not while I'm watching, but but they litter. I get that pre-Al-Anon tone of voice in talking to certain persons. One of the slogans that I've seen on bumper stickers is to think globally and act locally. I think that's a good suggestion. I want to pay attention to the world. I want to know what's going on. I want to see the ups and downs. I want to participate. But as far as my behavior goes, I've got to throw that into a local place. A thing or two on just again on depression for those who've dealt with it some. What can one do in depression? Self-care becomes real important. Forcing oneself to eat intelligently. Forcing oneself to do a little bit of exercise, forcing oneself to get to a meeting, are three important things I can do when I get down. And if I can only do two of those three, I think that's good. And if I can only do one of those three, I think that's good. I don't beat myself up because I'm not operating on all cylinders. I'm just kind of glad that any motion is there at all. But when I can take care of those, I'm in a pretty good place. What else do I know? Accepting limitations is a great freedom. And the reason it's a great freedom is because it puts us in an honest place. Talking to my sponsor again, you know, this I mentioned the Al-Anon balance, that Al-Anon skill of being able to have conversations without doing a lot of blaming or a lot of taking responsibility that's not ours. What Terry told me once was at meetings, talk about real things. Or when you're talking to your sponsor or you're talking to a significant friend, talk about real things. And when you're talking about real things, you know, the things that are plus, that are minus, but they're real. They're inside here. Do it without beating yourself up. I'm so bad. Nah, stop that. That's luxury. Why do you think you're competent to judge yourself accurately? You have judged no one else accurately in your life. Well, you have special insight into your craziness. You know? Again, God is the one who can handle each of us well. This is why we have hope. What will God's judgment be on me that I need a lot of meetings? I can handle that. That I have lots of healing. Yep. I don't mind that judgment. Tom's moody. Oh, he really is. More than you know. But I want to be able to talk about my stuff without beating me up. And without letting me off the hook. I mean, the reason I took the money is because she left it out. Is missing the fact that I took the money. Let me talk about what's going on. Some of the feelings, some of the behaviors with some people I can trust. And I find if I can do that in that kind of balance regularly, I walk through things. Things change. Things get bigger. Things get smaller. Things get richer. Things get poorer. But things change. And if change is going on, you know life is going on. And I think the Al-Anon program invites us to have a life instead of waiting for everyone else to shape up so we could have a life. Have a life. Well, I'm going to start living as soon as these 9 things happen. It's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. One of the reasons some of us are a little angry, and by the way, I presume anger. Whenever I'm talking to anybody, I just presume anger. And I presume hurt. Because if you've been around at all, there's a lot of hurt and anger. How can we talk about that? How can we live in that? But one of the reasons some of us are angry is our deep, deep, deep question is, when is it going to be my turn? See, I've been waiting to get in line, but no one's letting me in. When is it going to be my turn? And it's going to be your turn when you take it. Think of good old Susan B. Anthony. Well, one day men just decided to give women the vote. Oh, that's not true. A lot of people had to fight a lot of years and stared the men down to give them the vote. And they had to face ridicule and humiliation and jail and forced feedings in jail and lots of stuff. It's a great story, old Susan B. I see if I, again, this is, no one is asking my opinion on this, but I would have a national holiday in her honor too. As one of the 3 great Americans, or I guess 4, Lincoln, Washington, Martin Luther King Jr., and Susan B. Anthony. Talk about significantly changing the lives of lots of people. Oh well. One more cause. And I like them. But it's the little victories. Sometimes our expectations are so high. Well, I want the whole family to change. Well, that might not happen. You know, that might not happen. In Lois had to do a lot to cope with a difficult living situation. In this book, again, The Soul of Sponsorship, there's a little introduction. Bill's depressed. It's 1940. He's almost ready to meet Father Dowling, and this is what it says. That night, a cold, damp November night in 1940, Bill W., co-founder of AA, had gone to bed. His feet were hanging over the end of the bed, which nearly filled the small room he and his wife Lois had rented on the second floor of the 24th Street AA Club in New York City. He's been sober 5 or 6 years. They have rented a room in the back of the AA clubhouse. And she stayed with them. I mean, this is... 2 orange crates with curtains served as their dresser. Hooks on the wall held their clothes. Lois supported them with her job at a department store. She worked at Macy's. She's the one that had the check that came in that paid the bills. This is high stress. Now, the next line, though, I think is profoundly hopeful. It reads, that night, she was out somewhere. Gee, I think I'll stay home with Bill, who's real depressed. Or go bowling, you know, or go to a movie, or walk. That night, she was out somewhere. She was taken care of. She may have been talking to someone who made her laugh. You know, instead of Bill, who was, well, here he says, Lois, that night she was out somewhere. Cold rain and sleet were beating on the tin roof above him. Bill was wondering whether the pain he was feeling in his stomach was an ulcer. Gee, I'd love to stay home with Bill and talk about that. Lois had the common sense to have a life. She was out somewhere. And sometimes, for some of us, that means getting out for an afternoon or out for a morning. And if you know someone in high stress, and we've done this with people who've had, you know, chronic illness and dealing with people sick with AIDS and so forth, and the caregivers are around. You know, what can you do? Sometimes it's saying, listen, Fred, I'll take care of things. Why don't you take the afternoon off? And every so often, just go help out. You know, which means sometimes just babysitting. But you give the person under the major stress, under the major burden, an afternoon off. And sometimes they hate that. They hate the afternoon off because they'd rather be home. You know? Being crazed. Our craziness is as addictive as anything else is. And to learn how to take some time for ourselves is a grace. And when you start doing that, it's one of the, not little victories, one of the great victories. And if that just means an afternoon or an evening, that's a big deal. Because many of us need all the strength we can get, and there are places to get that strength. And we have to know where to go, and as grown-ups, get there. One of the poems that I've always thought had a lot to do with our journey is written by an American poet named Mary Oliver, and it's called The Journey. And she describes the process real nicely. And here's what she writes. This is in her book of poems called New and Selected Poems by Mary Oliver, the winner of the Pulitzer Prize. This was a few years ago, Pulitzer Prize for poetry. I'm not a big poetry reader, actually. I'm too speedy. And like I say, my bedtime reading is usually horrific serial killers. Always makes me relax and puts me right to sleep. There's been a lot of dismemberment and police involved. But I forced myself to read some poetry because you have to do it slowly. And if your insides are like mine, you have to read it two or three or four or five times to get it. And that's countercultural. We want to skim and do a sound bite and, you know, then vote. Instead of processing stuff through and taking a look at it and chewing on it and flavoring it and then making a decision, do I like this or not? And that's a lifetime process. But I like a lot of Mary Oliver. A lot of her stuff is writing about nature. She writes about the outdoors and otters and snakes and stuff, you know. My one snake story, and it's an Al-Anon story too, last May, I guess, I got to go to central Mississippi and did an Al-Anon weekend there, which was a great privilege. And I've done that a couple of times. And one of the very prominent Al-Anon persons in that part of Mississippi is a fellow named Skip. And Skip is a potter. He is a craftsman. He is an artist. He makes wonderful things with his hands. And he's born and bred in Mississippi his whole life and has never lived anywhere else. So he likes all that, you know. And Mississippi, by that I mean, it's a very rural state. And it's forests and people hunt and they really do shoot squirrels. I mean, it's just amazing. And eat them. I mean, this is shocking to me. The first time I went to Mississippi, I was a little anxious and trying to be on my best behavior, and I remember noticing, I mean, there was a little lake, and there were swampy territories, and there were little rivers, and it was marshy all over the place. And I asked one of them, do you have wildlife? It's a big hunting state. They have wildlife all over the place. They've got, you know, deer, and they've got possum, and they've got skunks. They have a lot of stuff in Mississippi. A lot of, and cats, things, fond of animals, we've got copperheads and snakes and coral snakes and we're just thick with snakes. And I said, well, where do all these little snakies live? And he said, wherever there's water. Which meant I was surrounded. Skip was on the pad, and in my that night he said there was an alligator in the lake and I should come and see it, and I was such a snob. I couldn't do it. Now, I'm going to look at it now, but this was an alligator. Give me a break. You know, this sounds like he wants me to participate in a National Geographic shoot. You know, I'm a silly kid. I'm sophisticated. Leave me alone. So consequently, I didn't go see the alligator. You know, so my loss is I was stupid. I'm capable of losing from stupidity. So I was talking using images that I think is Mississippi State, you understand. One day you finally knew what you had to do. I spend a lot of time not knowing what I have to do. That's part of the rhythm for me. I mean, it's just not clear. It's not obvious. I know something maybe should happen, but I don't know where or when, and all of a sudden something falls into place. One day, you finally knew what you had to do. And began. That's an important part of recovery. Some of us know what to do. We don't do it. But one day, finally knew what you had to do and began. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. And they always shout. They're always experts. And they always make us miserable. Some of the best experts I know are some of the most miserable people. And they shout their advice. Oof. I used to shout back. Now I change the channel. Though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. You're trying to get out the door and they're holding on. You just passed out, but holding on, you know, dragging bodies across the room. Mend my life! Mend my life! Take care of me! Fix me! Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations. It's hurricane time. You know, it's chaos. It's a disaster. And it's time to take some action. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. I mean, it's pathetic. It was already late enough. And a wild night. And the road full of fallen branches and stones. For many of us, on the day we decide to take some action, there's nothing around us but wreckage. Well, I'll take some action soon as someone else cleans up the road. It was already late enough and a wild night and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind,